Hello, I'm Kyle Jones. This lecture concerns itself with time, light, and the theological dynamism between the two as an answer for my student concerning types of beginnings. As a preface, I would like to state that I believe that the Bible is a collective theology, both as a contract of words and their meanings found in the Bible and a contract to the corresponding universe that we live in. Therefore, I believe in Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, which states, quote, "For by him, that is the Christ, were all things created that are in heaven and that are in the earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created by him and for him, as he is before all things, and by him all things consist." Concerning a very light glimpse of this order or type of order, take for example genetic and historical linguistic order. Look at our word etymology. It means the study and history of words in its basic definition. A closer look at word etymology, or the word etymology, we find that it means the, quote, study of truth. Etymology as a word can be found having its history and linguistic genetic affiliation within the archaic Indo-European root word daro. Daro is the archaic Indo-European root for etias, where we find our root word for etymology. Dr. Jacob Grimm was one of the first academics to find word histories based on a fairly ingenious chart of labials, dentals, rotors or rotex, palatals, liquids, etc. that he had contrived, and which we call Grimm's Law. Such examples of Grimm's Law might be found in application, as seen from the harder D sound in the old world that becomes the softer T sound as time evolves. And the rotex or the R sound would soften to the rotex ya or la sound. And for the case of the dra or daro, we can follow a simple Indo-European rule of thumb that D became T and R remained R, or maybe even a softer R, as in the example of dra to tra. Such linguistically genetic affiliations can be found in our English words such as tree, druid, truth, etymon, etymology, okay? I'm trying to harden the T-Y-T-R-D-R to show you this is the root found in these words. These words all have a linguistic genetic relation. Again, take for example, etymon. For an etymon is the root meaning to the word observed. The current word in living use would be either the stem or branch. Let's further this family meaning, both etias and daro, in meaning of truth. In application, truth or daro can be seen in our word druid. Draid is a composite of dra, which means tree, and or truth, and the word ido or idon. This means to see. Druid, therefore, can convey the sense of seer within the trees or of the trees, hence our word druid. So, our Indo-European roots are close in genetic affiliation, which gives us our final sense for the pregnant forms of daro, dra, tia, tra, meaning, once again, root to stem to branch. Now, with that said, there is much more involved than just applying Grimm's Law to everything, quote, linguistic or philological, end quote. But for anyone interested in this study, please go purchase Calvert Watkins' Indo-European Roots book to get started on such an endless pursuit. With that said, one might refer to the book written by Simon Winchester called, quote, The Meaning of Everything, end quote, where we encounter one of the greatest minds of all time, Dr. James Murray, a man who loved etymologies and who could nearly break down the meaning of any English word or other given to him. We have him to thank for concerning the unabridged Oxford English Dictionary. It should not come as a shock to you that Dr. Murray believed in a sovereign Christian God who brought all things into order, including language itself. I believe that the further one goes into the study of etymology, one finds a governing force holding our meaning together. I call this logos. Let's begin. Our Anglo-Saxon theological scholar, Alfric, wrote a series of antiphons, that is, devotional or liturgical compositions, which traditionally accompanied an earlier Latin petition called the Magnificat at Advent. Alfric's antiphon went something like this in Anglo-Saxon. Nod the sylph kim, that thou inlot, that the long or, throws me bethot nod in theostrum, her, satin senat, which means, quote, and come yourself, the physical Christ, that is, so that you may illuminate those who for a long time have sat here in the eternal night, covered by smoke and darkness. We read further in this antiphon to see Christ being called the Arendelle. In Alfric's Anglo-Saxon world, Arendelle meant the dayspring, that is, the source of illumination. Christ, therefore, is the Lucifer, or Lucifer as it should be known. Prior to the Old English's religious use of such a word, Lucifer meant the light bearer, from where the Latin and Greek cognates show. Luci is the Latin from which we get the meaning of shining, illuminating, enlightening, etc. And Phero is from our Latin and Greek, which means to bear or to uphold, to carry over or to transport. But there is a false theological light that we might turn to for a moment in order that we might, once again, turn back and delineate and distinguish what this true light might be. In Isaiah 14, verse 12, we find only one mention in the King James Bible, by name, of Lucifer. In Isaiah's Hebrew, Lucifer is called Halal, which means, O day star, or O great shining one. Isaiah's Hebrew continues Lucifer's title as Son of Don, or Ben Shocker. In Isaiah 14, we capture Lucifer in his contrasting nature. That is, his fall from Son of Don, O great day star, to Dweller of the Pit of Sheol. And I'll say the Dark Pit of Sheol, for that matter. Isaiah's Lucifer is seen in his high ascendancy and then his lowness in accord to the ground, which we can also see in the Nakash, or serpent's final curse, of Genesis chapter 3, verse 14. Quote, to his belly he will crawl all of his days. Isaiah says that the same one who fell to the ground was, quote, that one who laid the nations low, who shall be scoffed at by man for his seeming impotency. Another depiction of Lucifer can be seen in Ezekiel. The beginnings of Ezekiel's Luciferic description starts in time and leads us somewhere to the numinous. It is interesting that Ezekiel's description of Lucifer is nearly the reversal of John's gospel formula, for John's logos comes from the numinous and enters into the, quote, field of time and tempo, end quote. With that said, this false Lucifer begins in time as the king of Tyre. This particular king of Tyrus was marked in history as Ithabalus II. Ithabalus was a mere man, a king of mortal blood. He was concurrent with Ezekiel's ministerial and prophetic deployment around 590 BC. In this most amazing depiction of the spirit within Ithabalus, we realize that there's more being addressed than just Ithabalus. Ezekiel's use of pleonasm, or redundancy to the fill, is shown in Ezekiel 28, as Ezekiel concerns Ithabalus with the preface of thou each time he is addressed, well, thou being noted as the Hebrew suffix da. Such pleonasm, or repetitive striking, drives Ithabalus, the man, more and more out of the way, uncovering the Lucifer that settles behind such a mere tyrant. In Ezekiel chapter 28, verses 13 through 17, we see the beautiful account of this species of the Satan. Quote, "Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God, and every precious stone was thy covering, the sardius, topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, the carbuncle, and the gold. The workmanship of thy tabrets and of thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day that thou was created." Well, for a moment, I would like to say that the Old English gerund tabret, or drumming, comes from the Hebrew root word tophe, which also is a gerund, and which can connote rhythmic nature, even as far as to say the rhythm or trend of the day. That is, what is popular today and or why we laugh or muse at this and that today but not tomorrow. Or, if I might take license for this one, what rhythmates us to do so-and-so, etc. Well, call me a nomothete on this one. I will take the blunt for it. Let's continue. Verse 14, "Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth, and I have set thee so. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire." Verse 15, "Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day that thou wast created, till iniquity was found in thee." Verse 16, "By the multitude of thy merchandise they have filled the midst of thee with violence, and thou hast sinned. Therefore I will cast thee as profane out of the mountain of God, and I will destroy thee, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire." Verse 17, "Thine heart was lifted up because of thy beauty." And just for a moment, if I may interject, yiphah was the word for beauty. And as defined in the Hebrew, it means, quote, "beauty as a woman, desirous beauty, shining or radiant." Well, let's continue. Quote, "Thou hast corrupted thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness." Still, yiphah is used here. Our sense for the type of satanic brightness is rather a reflection of the beauty as appearance, as we see in Isaiah, rather than the actual substance or substantial. Another way to put it, the superficial aesthetic versus the source or the thing that light really is. Well, for that, let's return to our good light, which the ancient Hebrews called the heavenly bodies. The Hebrew word for such a light is more like lamp to us. In the Hebrew, me'oroth is the word for lamp, or of the lamp as light. We find the plural orim used in Genesis chapter 1, verse 14, to mean lights. To the Hebrew mind, it is within the varying intensities of light and warmth that time is defined by. The time when the sun is at its apogee and with full intensity is the time considered to be the day in its utmost Hebrew sense. Likewise, when the moon is in apogee, we have the orim or heavenlies, that is the stars, to define night and not the moon. Therefore, it is when the stars give their truest illumination that we have what the Hebrews would have called night. We find in Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 through 14, that the quality of this light and dark state was called into creation prior to creation. As light and dark had a deeper reality with God, it was relayed into and as time for, as I have already said, the deeper reality, which will come again as a portentous fulfillment. From Genesis chapter 1, verse 5, we find that the light of day on earth is expressed in Genesis chapter 1, verse 14, as the contrasting component of night, which is signaled by the heavenlies, or the oth in the Hebrew, and not the moon, which only reflects light. Oth means both stars and the things to come as a portent or future regal event. These same stars are set in the heavenlies to divide light and darkness, day and night, and to rule over them, and by doing so, they establish times as they should be theologically understood. What is necessary to understand here is that God separated such qualities as night is to day, so as light is to dark, and as is stated in Genesis chapter 1, verse 17, in order that the heavenlies or the stars, by their numerical assignation or assignment, would bring forth the message of portent or things to come of a Messiah in their kairos or appointed time. Kairos being the Greek word for appointed time. And as we see in Psalms chapter 19, verse 1 and following, I will do some form of footnoting in this as I read this, and we will continue next week after this this passage of Psalms. Quote, the heavens declare the glory of God. Well, declare here means to rehearse, implying repetition. And the firmament showeth his handiwork. Well, the firmament means the expanse. Day unto day uttereth speech, or day after day. Uttereth here is the word nabah, which is our word, our Hebrew word for prophet or prophecy. And night unto night showeth knowledge. Well, knowledge here means intelligence. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. That is, the whole world has seen this narration in the sky. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. And in them hath he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race. His going forth is from the end of the heaven, and his circuit unto the ends of the earth, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. Well, there's much more that will be said. For the sake of time, or lack of time, I must stop for now. God bless till next week when we can come closer to this dynamic meaning of theological time and light.